Today on Vox Talks Economics, discovering meaning at work. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, follow us, then you never miss an episode. And look for us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics. What's the point of having a job? Well, clearly it's to make money for ourselves and our families. But is it also possible to discover some purpose or meaning at work? And if you do, does it benefit you or does it benefit your employer as well? That's an idea that one global firm has had. And a team of researchers use an RCT to discover if encouraging employees to think about their purpose changes the way they work. And the results show that programs like this might have positive results, but it also gives a clue as to why they often do not. Oriana Bandiera of the London School of Economics, CEPR Fellow, of course, is one of the authors of a CEPR discussion paper based on this research. She joins me now. Oriana, lovely to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tim.
What then constitutes the alienation of labor? First, the fact that labor is external to the worker, that in his work he does not feel content but unhappy, does not develop freely his physical and mental energy. The worker, therefore, only feels himself outside his work, and in his work feels outside himself. He feels at home when he is not working. And when he is working, he does not feel at home.
Oriana, that's Karl Marx. He was writing in 1844. I mean, our living standards have changed enormously since then. Work has changed, hopefully, for most people since then. Is this concept of the alienation of labour, is it still relevant today?
I think it's even more relevant today than it was when Karl Marx was writing. Because at the time, if you think he was writing about factory workers, Factory workers could see what they were doing, could see the output of their work. Although, of course, the profits went to the capitalists, at least they were connected to what they were doing. Think the complexity of the organization of production in most firms today. If you're working for a multinational, say that you're an accountant in Leeds, The multinational is a global chain that has production in Bangladesh. You have no idea. You have no way of measuring, of seeing what it is that you're spending all day doing, what impact it has. So in that sense, I think alienation is bigger, stronger today.
So if we are alienated, how does it affect us? How does it affect our attitudes to our work and to our lives as well?
Exactly as you say, there is work and there is life. We see this as two opposite concepts. Mm-hmm. And people talk about work-life balance. But normally what's opposed to life is not pleasant, right? We are thinking more about, think of professionals. Say, Tim, do you like your job?
I'm lucky. I do like mine. But I know that many of my friends do not.
There you go. Whoever likes their job says that they're lucky. Mm-hmm. It is an exception to like your job, but it doesn't have to be. And that's exactly the idea behind this intervention.
But since 1844, our living standards have risen out of all proportion, all conception that anyone at that time could have thought about. But that hasn't resulted in us spending any less time at work, if you look at the statistics. If doing our jobs is so horrible, why are we still at work all the time?
It's a matter of coordination. You know, firms hire people, they offer you a contract. The contract doesn't have the choice of less pay for less hours. Mm-hmm. I think the pandemic was a fantastic case study on this. The moment people were allowed not to go to work, nobody wanted to return.
And if
you walk the corridors of the LSE, all the faculty was here and all the support staff were at home.
For this, you've worked with a multinational, and that multinational created a Discover Your Purpose initiative. So the purpose they're talking about here, is this the job description that's included in your contract, or is it something else?
No, it's something completely different.
Yeah.
It's more the way you see life and what makes you happy on a day-to-day basis. So it's not things like grand purpose, things like saving the blue whale. Mm-hmm. Just coming back to the example of the accountant, There's no way a spreadsheet can ever help you save wages. But it's the way you approach work and the way you approach your coworkers. If I put myself in the shoe of somebody who's very tidy and likes organization, which is very difficult for me to do, but if you are that type of person and your purpose is to have everything in its place, if you understand that, you can implement that at work and that will give you happiness. It's something very basic, much more everyday than grand ambitions.
Recently, we made an episode about the remarkable work that Joachim Voth and David Lagarkas have done using AI to discover what elderly Americans in the 1930s found had given their lives meaning. And sure enough, many of them found meaning in their work. Listen to the episode, A Meaningful Life, from 18th of April this year.
Now, this is very unusual. It sounds very strange to hear this from a multinational corporation. What's the intention behind Discover Your Purpose? Were they wanting to increase their profitability, make more money, or do they genuinely want to make the people who work for them happier?
Well, no company ever wants to make less money.
Well,
but there is the belief that the happiness of the workers and the profits of the company can go up together. And that's what they were aiming at.
Right. So imagine that I am working for this company and I'm going to take part in one of these DYP, Discover Your Purpose sessions. What am I going to be expected to do?
I can tell you exactly because I did it myself. I took
part
in one of them, yes.
Wow.
To understand how they work. So they give you some materials to read beforehand and you have to write 4 stories about yourself.
Uh-huh.
And the stories are about your first memory before you knew what good and bad was, then your most challenging moment, and then your most successful moment, and finally, what sparks your interest. Now, many people are very suspicious or skeptical.
Yeah.
But during the workshop, you tell those stories because we all have those stories in us. And what happens is that you see a consistent pattern in all of them, and you see what makes you think that you're having an impact on people. So, for example, I can tell you mine.
Okay, yes, please. You know you're telling other people as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I realized that I have a way of seeing different points of view, and that if I'm able to make other people see different points of view, cooperation in the workplace increases. And when I manage to do that, I'm happy.
Okay.
I just wanted to make the example to make it concrete what it means. Then, of course, I want to solve poverty in the world and many other lofty things, but that's not what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, and that's not part of this DYP. That's a completely different sort of goal.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. Now, when I have decided on my purpose, I've reached that point that you reached. What is a good purpose within the context of this program? Is it supposed to be a sort of a common goal that you can share with other people in the organization, or is it personal to you? And is it always about doing your job better, or is it about just living better?
It's entirely personal to you. It's not specific to the corporation. And actually, contrary to most incentive schemes or other corporate purpose initiatives, it's not specific to the firm. You can take it with you if you leave.
Ah.
And that has a massive impact on the way this works, both on productivity and happiness. Because once you've learned what gives you meaning, the firm cannot take it away from you.
How well-founded is this? Do we have evidence that if everyone finds their purpose like this, it makes a difference to how people behave at work? Having gone through this, is there some reason why I would behave differently afterwards?
So that's why we ran the RCT with the company.
Yeah.
And we found that the first thing is that people who were very unhappy in their job, but were very well paid, so they were staying for the money, those were the first people who left.
Interesting. So you have this training, this program to find out what their purpose is. And some people, part of finding their purpose made them think, what am I doing here?
Exactly.
That's risky for the company, though, surely, isn't it?
It depends, because if these are the people who are less productive, it's actually quite a good thing.
Okay. And if you have people who don't have a purpose, then we assume at some point they're going to run out of reasons to work there anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell me about how you structured this experiment, because you did this as an RCT, which is, again, unusual in these corporate environments. What did you do?
That was quite difficult.
Well, yeah.
We had, you know, the company doesn't have time to play with us. So we structured it in the simplest possible way for them. We randomized the invitation to the workshop. So we were working in 14 countries. We cooperated with the HR staff in these 14 countries, and we just randomly sent emails. In any case, the rollout is never instantaneous because they cannot possibly give the treatment to everybody at the same time.
No, because it ended up with thousands of workers, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So in any case, you have to wait for your turn to do it.
Uh-huh.
So instead of waiting for the turn being chosen in a non-random way by a computer, we chose the order. That's all.
Okay. And this means that workers at every level of the organization doing every type of job, which must be a lot of different types of jobs, they were all involved. It wasn't just an executive program, for example.
It started as an executive program, but in our experiment, we only look at white collar workers.
Okay.
All at the same level. So we wanted to keep some control.
And this DYP program is delivered to them. It's done with internal trainers?
Yes.
Okay. So what did you set out to measure as an outcome of this, and how do you measure it?
So, you know, that's the main challenge. And that's
yes.
the challenge also that we face with incentive schemes.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to pay people for performance because the performance is very hard to manage. But the company has a system of measuring performance, and that's what they use to pay bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a, you know, a mix of objective and subjective evaluation. So we measure that. We take the administrative data from the company that tell us whether people have improved on their own measuring scheme. For salespeople, we can look at revenues, the amount of sales in the group. And finally, we have a battery of tests that measure meaning, that measure happiness.
So you had some people who, having gone through this, they decided that actually doing this job really wasn't for them. And so they separated from the organization. We have to assume because they did that voluntarily, that is a positive outcome for them. For those that stayed, do these measurements show that they were more productive afterwards?
Yes, they do. And somewhat unusually, the improvement came from the very bottom of productivity.
Ah.
Normally, we know well-known results are when we give incentive pay,
mm-hmm.
with the top people that do even better because they can do so at an incentive. In this case, it's the people at the very bottom. So some of them left and those who stayed improved.
See, that's interesting as well, because I would have assumed that if you put a program like this in place, then the least performing people within the organization would be the least engaged and might get the least from it. But it seems that you're finding the opposite.
If you do it voluntarily, if people are free to choose when to do it, it's going to be the most engaged who do it first.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, that's what, because this is an unusual setting, because we can compare the results of the experiment to the results that you would get if you were to use observational data. That is where the rollout would be chosen by the employees themselves.
Yes, which would be a normal way for a multinational corporation to do these things.
Yeah.
It's offered to you. You're not randomly selected in it.
Yeah, no, very few companies, multinationals, will not use experiments to evaluate
yes.
their pilot.
Yes. And apart from the productivity, was there a change of behavior in the workplace? Were people acting differently afterwards?
For what we can measure, we measure team cooperation, and that remains unchanged. Their happiness is higher.
Uh-huh.
The self-reported happiness is higher. And actually, this is quite interesting. When you ask people about their priorities, those in the control group put work-life balance at the top.
Right.
Nobody in the treatment group does.
So an intervention that is actually directly inspired by this idea of having a work-life balance, once they've had that intervention, that's not something that they're thinking about.
No, because they don't see as work as something that's the opposite of life.
Very, very interesting. Now, of course, if they've improved their performance, they're earning better bonuses as well, I guess.
Yeah. So this is one essential component of it. It must be understood that this intervention only works if the firm is willing to share the benefit with the workers. Because as I mentioned earlier, the intervention stays with you if you leave. So had the firm tried to extract all the extra surplus remaining with the Marxist terminology, workers would have left. So there is a very large increase in surplus, which is split half and half between the workers and the firm.
Arianna, is this program paying for itself? Because it must be quite expensive to deliver.
So we do a cost-benefit analysis and it pays for itself in a year. If you were to hire external consultants, which of course are much more expensive than your own employees, it would pay itself in 2 years.
As you say, the way that these things are usually done in the business environment is people volunteer for them and people have an idea that it might be doing some good because people answer questionnaires and they look at productivity. This was running for a couple of years beforehand. Before they called you in, did they know that it was a success?
The way they put it is that they knew, but for the wrong reasons.
Right.
Because, you know, when you ask people to volunteer, it's the best people who volunteer. So the best people are best in the sense of most productive and most attached to the firm. Mm-hmm. But the best people are good no matter what you give them. So there wasn't such an improvement in productivity. But once they saw the data, they were quite taken, let's say.
The one lesson from this is for anyone listening to this from a multinational corporation, you should maybe do more RCTs. We can't really solve that with this podcast. This is a very unusual organization. You just do not hear this talked about in this way or evaluated with the commitment that they've obviously given to it. Many more firms that I speak to and their employees when I speak to them, they have embraced things like low attachment jobs without training, temporary contracts, 0 hours contracts, gig work. They're also very excited at the moment about how they can make AI agents to replace workers, which means that many workers are feeling very insecure in that environment. Could any of those firms credibly introduce anything like this, or is it only a particular type of firm that can make this work?
So definitely, all you need is the willingness to share the surplus. Mm-hmm. If the intention is to extract every piece of surplus that you generate, then that's not going to work. But the technology itself and the level of the employees don't matter too much because we know that we're working on evaluating the same program for blue-collar workers and for the executives of the firm. And there is no reason why the principle shouldn't apply. Firms face a choice between treating workers like machines and try to substitute machines for workers, like with the AI, or treat workers like people. It's two solutions for the same problem. I think as long as the AI cannot substitute everything that we do, there's always need to motivate people. And people can only be truly motivated if they do what they want to do for its own sake.
It's a very interesting time for corporate culture. Let's hope many other workers feel lucky to be at work in the future. We have that potential, so let's make it real. Arianna, thank you for talking about it.
You're welcome.
The paper is discussion paper 20230. It is called Meaning at Work, and the authors, Nava Ashraf, Oriana Bandiera, Virginia Minni, and Luigi Zingales.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, does banning cars from city streets cost votes?